All right. Words to the wise. If the two words, two phrases, actually just a few words, iron bad, copper good. That's what a lot of people are saying. They've gotten on to the reality that too much iron is, hell, almost any supplementary iron is no good. And now they're buying into the copper is the magic bullet. It's the answer. It's the be-all, the end-all. So iron bad, copper good. Wrong. And we've made this quite clear in the past. So we're going to run over this one more time. By the way, it is interesting to see how when we do present things here, how within a day or two they kind of pop up on other rather notable venues, shall we say. We've never gotten one notice of thanks or notice that they don't attribute anything anymore. People just take, which is fine because we want to get the word out there as far and wide as possible. But the measure of the people in this business is not very strong anymore. It's pretty weak and pretty lousy. There are a lot of frauds in this game who are on it. They're in it. They're on it for reasons that have to do with ego. Theirs. They're stars. Quickest way to become a celebrity in history is to start a podcast. Never mind that there are only three people listening and watching. Doesn't matter, because you can say, I'm a podcaster. All right. Well, that's just the way it's always been. People always wanted to be a star or a social influencer now. I think that's the way they phrase it, isn't it, young lady? A social influencer?
Yeah. Yep. That's right.
God. Unfortunately, these influencers often are focused on the most trivial of pursuits imaginable. And then if they are focused on things that are of substance, they're wrong. And they're pushing the wrong protocols or the wrong theories. It just gets to be weird. Very strange out there. But it is good to see things that we talk about pop up elsewhere. I'm not going any further than that because the idea is to spread the word as much as we possibly can. So iron, bad, copper, good. Let's take that apart one more time.
Well, yeah, so there's a campaign out there that is scaring people off of iron, and we've talked about the risks of iron, and telling people that, you know, you want to get it out of your body, you want to avoid it, it's going to be a driver of aging, and, you know, that there is some truth to that. You know, if you do have a body that's become burdened with too much iron, that can lead to a lot of problems. But you do need some. And but what's being pushed lately is now that, you know, you can't manage your iron unless you have enough copper. And it's really copper that you're missing. And sadly, nothing could be further from the truth. If it appears that there's a copper deficiency in this day and age, it's usually because the person doesn't have the transport proteins for the copper. Something's going wrong with the transport of the copper. It's not really a frank deficiency, although it can look that way if you're only looking at the blood. You right. might see very low levels of copper in the blood and very low levels of ceruloplasmin, which is its carrier protein. But at the same time, their livers can be overloaded, and their brain can be overloaded, and their kidneys can become overloaded. And copper does quite a bit more damage, I would say. I don't know. It's probably a toss-up. But copper can drive oxidative stress just as much, if not more, than iron. And you definitely don't want a liver full of iron. And that's what these people are pushing, that, you know, you're not going to be able to complete the synthesis of heme without copper. Well, the synthesis of heme, which is how your body makes iron functional, is an 8-step process. And that process can go off the rails at any one of those points for any, you know, a number of reasons.
Keep that in mind. Keep that in mind. It's an 8-step process. That's important. And any one of those steps, you can go right over the side.
Yeah, and it may be because nutrient deficiencies. You need a whole suite of different nutrients to create heme. And it could be toxins. There are a number of toxins in the environment that can come in through the food, water, some air. I mentioned before lead and mercury are the most notorious, but there are others, chemicals that can disrupt the synthesis of heme. And so adding copper to a situation like that is not going to fix your heme deficiency, and in fact can make things much worse. And interestingly, I just read a paper today.
Real quick, before you go to your paper, what is the most common way of supplementation with copper?
Well,
are they pushing bags and bag bars of copper? Are they doing that too?
No, you can buy copper supplements. And one of the biggest pushers of copper out there right now is telling people that copper sulfate is perfectly fine. That's a fungicide, you know, that you would put in a pool. It's toxic.
Okay.
And that's the same form that they use on crops as a fungicide and pesticide. And you're literally taking a pesticide. And the downside of that is it will go right into your body. I mean, it just bypasses your intestinal mechanisms for controlling how much copper the body actually wants to absorb. So it will bypass that.
How does it pull off a fast one like that? How does it bypass? Real quick.
It's just an inorganic form of copper that gets right past those barriers.
Okay. And gotcha.
Goes right into the bloodstream and contributes to the what they call the labile pool of copper. And you don't want copper floating around freely in your blood. It does a lot of damage. And when the body cannot process it fast enough, it will store it in the liver. So the body makes, I think there's about 64 different proteins and chaperones to move copper around the body and within the cell. It
64.
Has to be. I think that's all the number I read. But, you know, the big ones are ceruloplasmin, and then you have ATP7A that controls the absorption of copper from the intestinal tract.
Copper is a real crowd pleaser in terms of the human body.
Well,
you
need it. You need it. It's necessary for a number of different enzymes and for creating energy and your antioxidant defenses, some of the SOD, for example. Right. It's a critical nutrient, but it's a trace mineral. We don't need gram amounts of it. And when the body doesn't know what to do with it, it'll store it in the liver. And that's why things like beef liver and cod liver are very high in copper. And
When I was a kid, I used to have to watch my grandfather prepare liver and onions. I remember the smell to this moment. I couldn't believe people would eat that beef liver. I was a kid. I still knew that the liver was pretty much the garbage disposal of the body.
What
are you eating that for? Yeah. So, anyway, go
ahead.
It
is. Just
flashed on that.
This is being pushed around also as some sort of a panacea for all that ails you. And, yes, it's very high in copper. And the other thing it's high in is vitamin A, which, you know, again, it's another nutrient that has to be very carefully regulated or it does a lot of damage. And so we now have...
You have a paper you were going to mention. Go ahead. Paper.
Yeah, okay. So this one was a researcher by the name of Anthony Mawson in Jackson, Mississippi. He's an epidemiologist, and he's been on a actually vitamin A bandwagon for a number of years, I want to say 20 years, and he tied in rubella with vitamin A toxicity. The mothers, pregnant women who got infected with the rubella virus, sustained damage to their livers, and at that point, when the liver was damaged, it began releasing retinal esters, which are derivatives of vitamin A, into the bloodstream. And it was actually the vitamin A that caused the birth defects in the babies. And he was also able to correlate the rise in autism with an epidemic of rubella back in the 1960s. The children that were born in that time, that's when... You know, there tended to be an increase in cases of autism. And so he's done a similar kind of review of that same phenomenon happening with vaccine injury, and this pertaining to childhood vaccines, that it's really liver damage that's causing a lot of the adverse effects that we're seeing and the spillage of these vitamin A esters unbound that are wreaking havoc. And then in 2021, he looked at the coronavirus, the SARS-CoV-2. And the virus does seem to have an affinity for the liver, gallbladder, and biliary tract. And once the virus gets into that organ, it does a lot of damage. And the consequence of that damage is, well, you'll see the very high ferritin levels, because iron is stored in the liver. And when it's damaged, that the high ferritin can be an indication that iron is being released from the damaged liver cells, and the ferritin is there to bind it. And also copper and vitamin A. In particular, these retinol or retinoids, esters that are released into the bloodstream and just wreaking a lot of havoc. Now, what would be the symptoms of that? Let's just say vitamin A toxicity, or what they call hypervitaminosis A, and headache. Let's see. What did I do with it? Rash,
yeah, rash,
itching,
yeah.
Loss of appetite, let's see, hair loss, cracked lips, dry or rough skin, liver damage, increased pressure on the brain, bone pain, changes in vision, nerve damage, fatigue, irritability, difficulty sleeping or concentrating. Well, how common are those complaints nowadays?
Right.
And so it's interesting that I think a lot of these people that are having trouble with the shedding and the aldehyde exposure, whether it's internal or external, are probably suffering some degree of liver dysfunction, maybe liver damage. And I know, at least with the vax injured, there is quite a bit of this non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, NAFLD, which you usually hear about in conjunction with, eating too much fructose. But high uric acid will damage the liver and cause this, and these people also have high uric acid due to the breakdown of purines in their bodies. So I think, you know, liver damage ought to be on the table, and people that are recommending copper, this is not going to help that situation.
Okay, here's a flash. That's good. You did a good update with that. So when you see people pushing copper, and a lot of people are still pushing iron, you don't need to do that, either one of them. Just don't. Eat right, take good care of yourself, eat clean food, try to clean your body, a normal, good, high quality, one a day, multiple vitamin and mineral is always a good thing to do, and you can build on that with whatever supplementation you want. We really like NAC, we like curcumin, glutathione is another one. We still like glutathione, don't we? Or do we caution people?
Yeah, there are some good protocols out there to clean the liver and support the liver. Because
that's
what's happening is, when red blood cells break down, the products of the breakdown have to be filtered through the liver. So you end up with high levels of bilirubin as a result of that process. And that can be a real strain on the liver. And so I don't know what to tell people, but other than, you know, you don't want to be putting copper into this situation. And I just see so much of it lately.
Yeah,
so we had Eric Berg come out with it this week. And now I guess Stephen Gundry. Yeah,
I thought Berg was pretty good.
he's
realized
got a
that iron was bad, but now he's gone to copper, right?
well, he's jumped on that bandwagon, and that's being promoted. And at this point, you have to wonder. I mean, we know now from these studies that have been done that the spike, or rather the copper, potentiates the toxicity of the spike protein. So
no one's talking about
that. When the spike comes into
contact
with copper...
No one's talking about that. That's a big deal. Go ahead.
It dramatically increases the amount of oxidative stress wherever that's happening. And if it's happening in the liver, you're going to blow up your liver with it. And we've had people on that protocol, many of them are women, because women tend to be overloaded with copper anyway because of the estrogen. They've actually gone into liver failure and ended up in the hospital.
This is terrible.
And that's, you know, those posts get deleted.
It's true. There's censorship.
So there's a cover-up going on. There's a push to get people to take copper, when in fact, you know, it's really quite pervasive in the environment. Our foods are sprayed with it. It's particularly organic. And if you're living in Europe, you know that they use copper sulfate extensively in agriculture. We have copper coming in from copper pipes, and it's
every
a driver
house,
of cancer.
Most every home is loaded with copper in the water anyhow, even if the water's filtered, purified, because it's going through copper piping. All right, anyhow, let's move on. We've got another story here that should alarm everyone, and I don't mean alarm in the sense that the story is written, but because they're pushing this with no real reason yet. California has declared a state of emergency over H5N1 bird flu. You must say, well, how many cases in California? Must be a lot of cases there. Have people died there now? No cases in California. This has happened just on the heels of the CDC reporting the first severe case of bird flu in Louisiana. So what does California do? It declares a state of emergency. This is nuts. Come on, people. They're just playing this fear card all the time. And it's got to get to a point where it doesn't work anymore. I hope we live to see it. But this is silly. Silly
stuff. Yeah, it is. It is. It'll be interesting to see how many people, you know, comply with this. What does this emergency entail? Are we locking down again?
Well, they're not too specific about that yet. I don't know. It's a state of emergency, that's all I can tell you. Crazy. Let's see, we've got another one here. If I can get this to play, it should work. This is an interesting one. And I think most of you who have been with us for any length of time know that we were right at the forefront of warning, imploring people to be aware of the danger of shedding. Now, this goes way back throughout history. Whatever the disease du jour or disease of the month happen to be, these are bacteria or viruses. And yes, there are viruses. And you just want to stay away from crowds of people. All right? If someone you have in your life as a very close friend is sick, let's say it's a woman, it's your girlfriend, for example, you want to get what she has? You know how to do it. Just exchange body fluids. That's one way. Breathing is the most obvious way. Shedding is real. Shedding is absolutely applicable to the COVID bioweapon nightmare. Now, there are many types of things that can be shed. Would you believe that people with cancer on chemotherapy are shedding chemotherapy? Yes, they are. This is a new issue. Yet another one, as if we didn't have enough. Chemotherapy can be shed to the extent that side effects of chemotherapy begin to appear in people who are not taking chemotherapy. All right, here's a short video. It's just over a minute long. I want you to listen to this. We'll come back to talk about this. So, by the way, this issue of they're presenting masks again in some locations. Don't think about that as being oppressive. Be happy about it. Masks, worn properly, will work. They're not 100%, but let's say they're 50% able to cut down on the transmission of bacteria and virus through the air. Aren't you happy with a 50% reduction? I would be. I am. I wear a mask everywhere I go. Even if it's 10%, I'll take it. You don't want to get this COVID virus, by the way, and it's, I forget, how many cases now? 970,000 new reports a day, if something like that? Didn't I send that to you?
I thought it was 700-something thousand.
Said, whatever.
Well, people are chronically infected now. They're not going to shake it.
No.
Because every round with that virus knocks down your T cells and...
And you become more open to all kinds of unpleasant pathogens. Here's this little video here about shedding chemotherapy. Don't laugh. Listen.
It is recommended that that person that is receiving treatment use a separate toilet.
Oh, she's got a very low voice. Let me start this again.
Same toilet as a person going through chemotherapy.
But she's talking about toilet use in the house, where someone in the house is taking chemotherapy.
Use the same toilet as a person going through chemotherapy. So if you have someone in your family that has cancer and they're going through chemotherapy, it is recommended that that person that is receiving treatment use a separate toilet than everyone in the house. If you're unable to use a separate toilet, it is recommended that the person receive treatments when we go to the bathroom that we not only flush the toilet 3 times with the lid down, but we clean that toilet immediately after using. The reason for this is if we use the toilet and we don't close the lid, and when you go to flush it and the water kind of sprays up and becomes airborne or gets on the surface of anything else, and someone who does not have cancer and is not receiving treatment could end up with dizziness, rash, nausea, vomiting, skin conditions, all type of just bad side effects. Long-term effects to being exposed to chemotherapy, and this is especially serious for healthcare workers, is you have a higher probability of having cancer down the line or fertility issues. Most people who are on chemo end up not being able to conceive down the road. Not everybody. Obviously, some people still have babies after receiving treatment, but it is a higher risk. Also, please just make sure that you're using proper precautions in your house. You're cleaning things the way that you're supposed to be cleaning with Clorox wipes, things like that. You're flushing your toilet with the lid down multiple times, and then you're cleaning the toilet. You're just being safe for everybody around you.
Okay. Words to the wise, no joke. Virtually anything of an infectious nature, or in this case, a scientifically chemical, pharmaceutical nature that is metabolized in the body, can be spread. It's called shedding. So be careful. Oh, and by the way, this toilet thing, if you have ever seen, and there are videos out there, maybe I should post one. YouTube has them. It's a video showing what happens when you flush the toilet. They've actually somehow impregnated the water in the toilet bowl with a green dye. And it goes up into the air when it's flushed in terms of aerosolized particulates. And there's a 6-foot cloud over and around the toilet. It's about 3 feet around the toilet, 6 feet high, almost momentarily after you flush it. It just bursts out. The flushing of a toilet creates an invisible plume. You can't see this unless you dye the water, of aerosolized pathogens that can spread infectious diseases. And as you just heard, it can spread the effects of chemo. The flush creates a chaotic jet of spray that can transport aerosols up to 1.5 meters high within 8 seconds. These aerosols can remain suspended in the air for many minutes or longer. Okay? So, quite seriously, if there's a window in the bathroom, and I believe there is in most cases, keep it open, unless it's the middle of winter and you're freezing, but even crack it open a little bit. Get some fresh air in there. Use the fan above the toilet. Code requires fans in bathrooms now. Whether it's directly above the toilet or neck, doesn't matter. Use the fan. Leave it on 5 minutes after you've used the bathroom to try to protect the people in the house around you. And they should do the same thing on your behalf as well. So, no joke.
And I would be mindful, too, of pets, because I'm now aware of two situations.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
one was a dog, and this person was undergoing chemotherapy and, you know, wanting to spend time with their dog. And the dog developed tumors and died in fairly short order, you know, in a matter of weeks, really deteriorated. And, you know, can you prove it was the chemo? Well, no, but we know the chemo sheds and spreads. And then more recently, I was aware of a local woman here who had just completed chemo and radiation, and her cat was quite sick, and she was looking for somebody to help her bring it to the vet. And before that could happen, the cat died.
I don't know how else we can try and make this clear. Talking about cats and dogs, breeders, dog breeders, if you let people come and handle the puppies and play with the puppies, they're going to contaminate the dogs, the puppies, with potentially spike protein and maybe mRNA, which may or may not infest the little puppy, or ultimately infest the new owner.
Yeah.
It's not fair to the dogs. And if you call the breeder and you ask, I'm interested in getting a whatever, a golden retriever. Are you and your husband, you're the breeders, are you both vaccinated? And many of them will get, I'm sure, very offended. But you have a right to ask that, and you should ask that, because they're shedding all the time. All right. I've just found a really good visual on toilet flushing. I'm going to post this tonight. I know it's funny, but it's not.
Well, you know, and look how many people now have cancer and are undergoing chemo that are, you know, walking around.
Well, it's one
places,
out of two
so
people
have
cancer.
About...
Cancer, or actually more than that now.
Yeah.
All right, here, just for fun. Here, I'm gonna. I like this. Looks like a good one. It's a minute long. Let's play this. See what the good doctor says about toilet flushing.
The average person flushes a toilet 5 times a day.
The reaction for most people has been one of disgust.
CU Boulder scientists are literally shining a light on what comes up when you push that handle.
You may find the results of the study are pretty gross.
Researchers used a green light laser. They aimed it at a toilet as it's being flushed to see the invisible.
We've learned so much by being able to visualize them.
Professor John Cromaldi, lead author on this study, says this is the first study to visualize the spread of toilet particles. It's not just gross, but the findings suggest what happens in a bathroom can be dangerous.
Those droplets can be disease vectors. They can transport pathogens.
The study found the particles shoot out at a speed of 6.6 feet per second. That means the plume reaches nearly 5 feet above the toilet in just 8 seconds.
I don't think most of us had any idea that in addition to the toilet taking this waste and moving it down out of the toilet, that it's simultaneously taking stuff from the bowl and shooting it up into the air.
And into people's lungs and on their skin, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not a joke. It's for real. So forewarned is forearmed. All right? Be careful. Common sense. All right. We are going next to take another look at... We've spent a lot of time talking about the catastrophic pathways to death that so many of the vaxxed or those who have had just the virus are potentially walking into. And certainly CJD, prion disease, mad cow death, is one that we've had a lot of examples to share with you. People are dying in a couple of weeks from diagnosis to death, not years like it used to take. There seemed to be a tremendous surge in the number of prion CJD deaths and cases, and there's no way back. So once you're diagnosed, you're dead. It's a death sentence. Just how long are you going to make it? That's what it is. Same thing with ALS, otherwise known as Lou Gehrig's disease. It's a bad one. So you've got CJD, ALS. We haven't even talked about myocarditis of the heart in a long time. But there are so many things that these terrible bioweapons do to the human body. It's not a joke at all. This is not hyperbole. It's not exaggeration. It's the truth. The idea of ALS is something that if I asked 100 people on the street, what about ALS? Unless they know someone who is dying from ALS, they wouldn't know a thing about it. Nothing. Might be one or two exceptions out of 100 or 500 people that would, but it's a bad one. Tell us about ALS a little bit, and we got a lot of readers to do about this. It's important. We talked a little bit in the last program about it, but I don't think you can talk about these things too much. They are gruesome, brutal ways of killing people, and that's what these injections were designed to do. Don't forget that. All right, what about ALS? How does it work? What does it do? We have a lot of newcomers each week, so it's good to repeat some of this.
Well, ALS is a motor neuron disease, meaning it affects the part of the brain or central nervous system that controls your ability to move. And quite typically, it'll start in the feet and ascend upwards so that it's an ascending paralysis. And by the time it reaches your lungs, when it does reach the lungs, which it eventually will, you die from not being able to breathe. And so there seems to be just an epidemic now of people manifesting an ALS-like.
Oh, it's surging. It's big.
Yeah, it's probably one of the fastest, but maybe Parkinson's is neck and neck with Parkinson's. But it's stunning, and the sad thing is many of these people are quite young, and others are middle-aged, but, you know, they have kids who are coming of age, and now the kids have the unfortunate task of having to care for their parents that are in rapid decline.
There's nothing more gruesome or grisly or difficult or heartbreaking than to have to take care of someone who is stricken with CJD, ALS, and unfortunately, and almost unbelievably so, many people in a family situation, whether they have kids at home or the kids are grown up, the family turns its back on the victim. Now, some of you may say, nah, it can't be. Oh, it is. It's true. Many of these people have CJD and they're dying, or ALS, and their family will have next to nothing to do with them. This is beyond belief, but it's true. How many times have we heard about this?
Yeah. The posts that I read, though, pertaining to ALS are usually the caregivers for these people. I don't. There are definitely vaccinated people who are all alone right now. There's no question, and abandoned essentially by their families.
Lots.
Their situation is almost as precarious. You know, it may not involve total paralysis, but it's still inordinately difficult.
Oh, it's terrible. All right, let's go and take a look at some of these ALS stories.
Give me a date. Which ones are you looking at? Because we can go all the way back to, I think...
Gee, I haven't had a woman ask me to take her out on a date in a long time. She said I have to give her a date, too. All right, whatever. Here we go. December 11th. Group number one. And we have ALS and the gut connection. ALS increase by, and there's 70% increase in this particular story. One of the major mouthpieces in the so-called antidote camp of the COVID wars, a certain chiropractor named Artis, has been taken to task by someone here. It can't happen often enough, in our opinion. Liver damage, persisting effects of group A strep. You seeing any of these?
Yeah.
It's a December 11th group.
Yeah, we did the group A strep ones, but we left the ALS. Yeah,
there's three group A strep that we didn't do, but the ALS is sitting up there at the top. So why don't you go ahead and start with that?
All right, I have said this many times before, but I do not believe it is mere coincidence that the most effective drugs found thus far in slowing ALS in trials happen to be an antibiotic known as Prime C and a deworming drug, Monopentel.
Hold it right there. A deworming drug suggests it's like ivermectin. It's a like a parasite cleanse, a deworming mm-hmm. drug. Worms are parasites. So I would suggest that perhaps Monopentel, if that's how you pronounce it, might be out of the same...
I think it's missing an N. Monopentel.
Gotcha. Monopentel. It may be out of the same basket as ivermectin. I'm just saying. Go ahead.
All right. The gut-brain axis is not some sort of tinfoil hat theory. It is supported by many reputable scientists, and more studies come out each month finding more evidence of this connection. I'd also like to note that antibiotics are just one avenue of hundreds or thousands that can cause gut balance to become disrupted. Ever travel internationally and get some form of food poisoning? Ever exposed to strange chemicals? Ever get an infection?
Hold it right
However,
there. Let's go back. Hold on. This is good. Anyone out there ever taken a course of antibiotics? You betcha. Probably 98% of the people living or listening and still living. And the problem is the antibiotics wipe out most, if not all, in some cases, of your digestive bacteria, which amounts to about 7 pounds per adult. And once you lose that wonderful symbiosis of bacteria in your digestive tract, you don't get it back easily. Some never get it back. So any antibiotic course is going to have all kinds of terrible side effects in terms of your digestive tract. And many say that the seat of the immune system comes from the gut bacteria. I've heard that
many times. About 70% of your immune system relies on a healthy gut microbiome.
Right.
Because these bacteria produce a whole array of different compounds. They call it, you know, this is your internal pharmacy, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
And they can synthesize vitamins that you need, like vitamin K and some other ones. And they can also produce antimicrobial peptides. And then they will, I mean, this is your interface to the outside world, even though it's inside of you. And these bacteria have some, maybe quite a lot of influence over what gets in and what gets kept out and signaling how your body should respond to it.
Gotcha.
So,
okay, carry on. However, in mice.
However, in mice with genetic predisposition to ALS, mice who were given repeated antibiotics developed onset, while those in the control group did not.
Wow.
There was a study in which a woman with ALS was given repeated treatments of washed fecal matter transplantation, and her symptoms went into remission until she required antibiotics post-surgery, not related to ALS. It is certainly a fascinating theory and one that should not be overlooked. I hope that Dr. Rick Bedlack is a prominent ALS researcher at Duke University, and he's the one that's collecting the case studies of recoveries from ALS, and there's a running total of about 60-something now of people who have had confirmed ALS and recovered.
And they beat it.
That's Rick Bedlack. Mm-hmm. Okay, I hope that Dr. Rick Bedlack and his team could do it justice and find out more about it. And someone says to that, my ulcerative colitis was going crazy right before my first symptom started. And another one says, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a gut connection. Interestingly, that drug, Prime C, is a combination between an arthritis drug and an antibiotic. And then there's also this. And he cites the paper where they describe this woman who had developed ALS and was given a what they call this fecal microbiota transplant and cured her ALS until she had to take antibiotics again and the symptoms came back.
Well, the idea is to try to repopulate your digestive tract with the proper and appropriate ratios of critically important bacteria. That's the idea.
Yeah, that's critical because they have honed in on, they believe there's a very strong connection with Clostridium, the bacteria that they call C. diff, Clostridium mm-hmm. difficile. And that is a really nasty bacteria that can often overgrow after you've had a course of antibiotics. And it does a lot of damage and apparently has some ability to translocate into the central nervous system where it starts affecting the neurons.
Gotcha. Okay, two more posts in this thread. Next one. My so experienced...
significant other.
What would I do without you? My... See, I don't read these in advance. We both just read them basically cold. My S-O, and there's no periods between them. It's just my so, my S-O, significant other. You'd think they'd at least put periods in there. Give me a chance. My significant other experienced a lot of her beginning symptoms, weakness in the left hand, now her foot, shortly after doing two rounds of separate antibiotics. I wonder if they killed all the good gut bacteria, which could have led her to accelerated progression. I know it might be wishful thinking. Oh, that's true. You cannot take antibiotics unless you really are taught, briefed by your doctor on how to try to rebuild your digestive biota.
Yeah, and you know, you've got to really be paying attention to what you're eating. You want to be feeding the beneficial bacteria with things like, you know, digestive resistant starches. We've mentioned, XOS, xylo-oligosaccharides and fructo-oligosaccharides. And, you know, any type of fibers, soluble fibers that, you know, you can't digest, but your bacteria love these things and they need them to proliferate and create their beneficial compounds. And then, you know, there's a lot of research going into the quality or the components of your bile. And a lot of times people's bile is really toxic enough to wipe out any beneficial bacteria.
We don't think of bile is usually going into the digestive tract.
Oh, yes, it is.
Liver bile. So explain how that works. Briefly.
Well, your liver produces bile so that it can solubilize things that it wants to get rid of.
It breaks them down.
Yeah, so bile is a way of carrying these toxins out of your systemic circulation. So your liver will conjugate toxins in the liver, and biotoxins are generally sent down the glucuronidation pathway as opposed to methylation or sulfation. Glucuronidation, and fortunately you can take a supplement called calcium D-glucarate that will support that, you know, getting rid of biotoxins, and that would include the spike, but it most definitely includes most mold toxins. So it will be excreted in the bile, assuming you have good bile flow or good bile production. If you have a congested liver or a gallbladder that's all plugged up with stones, things aren't going to go well, and that's one way you get this cholestasis and just a stagnant liver. And the bile starts to back up, and you get all kinds of problems. And a lot of people have that right now because they're deficient in choline, and you need choline to facilitate this process. So, you know, if you don't have enough choline in your diet, and that generally comes from animal foods, you know, it's very scarce on a vegetarian diet. The bile can be, you know, relatively toxic depending on what's trying to leave the system. And so as it makes its way through the intestinal tract, you know, your microbiome is exposed to that, and it can be beneficial or not. And there's a particular type of bile acid called TUDCA. It's a secondary bile acid that has really profound beneficial effects on things beyond the digestive tract, and in fact it's been looked at or considered and studied extensively for neurodegenerative diseases because it acts as a chemical chaperone for protein folding. And so you can find research that supports its use in treating Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and CJD. There seems to be a protective effect if you catch it early enough. If it's late in the game, it's probably not going to do a lot of good. So the quality of the bile and is really quite important in providing some protection against these neurodegenerative diseases.
And how does the pancreas fit into this bile issue and the gallbladder?
Well, it's all part of the same thing. I mean, you know, the whole digestive tract is, yeah.
It's all connected.
Yeah. So,
there's a lot of pancreatic cancer out there now. We'd urge all of you to do some exploration, look into the fenbendazole, ivermectin. Taking them together is very popular now, and there are a lot of good results. Now, they're anecdotal, but they're very important because they come from a broad spectrum of people, lots of people. All right, one more here. Let me get this. In this interview, neurologist Jay Lombard discusses the link between microbiota, dysbiosis, ALS, and other neurodegenerative diseases. He claims that in his practice, he encountered that almost all of his ALS patients were exposed to heavy antibiotic treatments prior to the development of the ALS disease. And he believes there's a clear link between bacterial imbalance and ALS. He also mentions a higher prevalence of GI diseases like SIBO, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's, and C. diff among these patients of his. It would be interesting to know what has been your or your pal's experience regarding antibiotic use and gastrointestinal comorbidities. I believe this is a very interesting line of research that could lead to potential therapeutic pathways. I think FMT has already shown some promising potential, although much more research is needed. So there's another link there that is ALS being triggered by a wipeout, a catastrophic ruination of your digestive bacterial bedrock. Think about it.
Well, or just being overtaken by these pathogenic forms that are able to move into the nervous system. You know, there's a link with Parkinson's in that, too. I'm not sure which strains of bacteria are implicated.
Right.
But there's a very clear link between what's happening in the gut in terms of the microbiome and, you know, what happens later on in terms of a person's risk for Parkinson's.
Right. All right, I want to do this last one here. This is important. People are often mesmerized or completely taken in by some spokespeople out there, and they shouldn't be. They should keep an open mind. They should do a lot of research. Do some background research, and don't rush to judgment on who you're going to believe. This Dr. Brian Artis, the chiropractor, has now pronounced nicotine as being a virtual panacea, a cure-all, and it's not. Now, this is a little segment. This is text taken from a segment on another talk show, Laura Lynn Tyler Thompson. Must listen. This is the most important information you will hear all day long. These are lead-ins to what I'm going to read you. Every virus on earth is beaten with nicotine. And here are the highlights from Dr. Artis. Nicotine is the cure for COVID. Nicotine was always the antidote and always the cure. Nicotine by itself has been proven to reverse, prevent, and even cure people with Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, arthritis, and more. Here's another one. Nicotine can reverse and dissolve brain tumors in less than 72 hours. Another one. Nicotine reduces autistic behaviors. Nicotine diabetes. Do you understand why they are trying to ban and outlaw all nicotine products? Please share. Everybody needs to know this. Well, there's another string of statements that are just off the wall at best?
Well, they're very sensationalized, and they lead people to believe that this is all they have to do to solve their problem. And I would beg to ask, is it going to solve my heme deficiency?
Or a hundred other things.
Is it going to solve my fatty liver?
You can't say this. Nicotine was always the antidote and always the cure for COVID.
No, but to be fair, there are a long list of therapeutic benefits
and nicotine
with nicotine.
Be helpful.
It does appear as though the pharmaceutical company wants this for themselves because they are going to exploit these therapeutic benefits. And they vary. There's several different ones. But they obviously want to patent it and you know, make money on it. And to do that, they're going to have to get it out of the public's hands.
Nicotine can reverse and dissolve.
That's a bold statement in saying that it's an antidote to anything or it's going to prevent you from Marburg.
Nicotine can reverse and dissolve brain tumors. Brain tumors in 72 hours. Gone. Glioblastoma.
And now I just saw that you know, if nicotine is not doing it for you anymore, because you will get habituated to the effects, then you've got to add in citicoline and mucuna, which is a form of precursor for dopamine. So
well,
none of this gets at the root of the problem. That's the problem. These are symptomatic. Therapeutic interventions that wonderful if it helps somebody, you know, have a break from their misery. That's great, and maybe it has some ability, like what we call this vasoactive intestinal peptide, which can reset the sympathetic nervous system so that you're not on hyperdrive all the time. It may have some use in that, but to be calling it an antidote to this virus, which is.
Quote. Here's the quote.
Extraordinarily complicated.
Nicotine was always the antidote and always the cure for COVID. Sorry, no. And most people develop we'll call it a tolerance to nicotine in relatively
habituation.
Short order.
Habituation. And how many? I mean, there were countless smokers who got COVID.
And died.
Did they not?
People smoking all the time are dying from COVID. Come on.
Yeah. You know, maybe they have a little bit less of the inflammatory cytokine effects, and that's one of the ways nicotine has been shown to be beneficial, is it can curtail that cytokine storm to some degree.
But these are all, they vary from person to person. This is not a silver bullet. At all, and it shouldn't be presented.
And it's leading people away from getting at the root cause.
That's right. Now, it needs to be examined and researched, but it does not need to be billed as always the antidote and always the cure. No, not okay.
I'd be more concerned about how much copper I have on board.
Very good.
No, seriously.
I hear you. No, that copper's nasty stuff.
You know, and iron right behind it. If you can't regulate those two metals, it's over.
I agree. All right, we have to run. We're running way late. Thank you. Great job.
Okay. Thank you,
Jeff. Take care.
Okay. Good night, everyone.
All right, we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. And again, we understand what nicotine does and doesn't do. We've studied this. It is not the antidote and always the cure. All right, we'll be right back.